This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. Today, we're spending the hour catching up with public media reporters around the state to find out what stories they've been working on and dig a little deeper into the context around those stories. We're first joined by Justin Hicks, workforce development reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting based in Elkhart. Justin's latest feature about free speech and a 12-foot-tall inflatable rat aired nationally on NPR. Welcome to the program, Justin.
Hey, Miriam. Thanks for having me.
We're going to listen to your piece in a minute, but before we do, how did you come across this story?
Yeah, so long story short, reporters, we monitor a lot of different agencies and different documents that come across our desk. And one of the agencies that I monitor is the NLRB. It's the National Labor Review Board. And I specifically kind of take a look at our regional office, which is in Indianapolis. But the regional office covers Indianapolis, parts of Illinois, a couple other little sections of other states, too. So I kind of found this because a decision was issued and it came across my desk.
Well, we're going to take a listen real quick to your story. This is the version that recently aired on NPR.
Turns out giant, grotesque rats have the right to free speech. Inflatable rats deployed by unions, that is. That's how one labor leader put it after a federal labor board recently ruled in their favor. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports, these rats are often used to signal a labor dispute.
A.C. Wurzbach and some construction workers from the Local 150 are protesting on a sidewalk in Chicago. They're flanking a 12-foot-tall inflatable rat they've nicknamed Scabby. It's got pointy teeth, red eyes, and depictions of scabs on its belly. And now it apparently has free speech rights, too. Wurzbach claims most people love this inflatable rat, though it's been run over, graffitied, and even stabbed.
One location that we were at, an irate lady came out, started stabbing it with a butcher knife. There's scars right here on the rat where it's been stitched back up to make it work again, but she was going to town, trying to kill Scabby.
Wurzbach says his union members are proud of those scars. It's why they request this beat-up inflatable, even though the union also deploys inflatable cats and pigs. No matter the character, the goal is to draw attention to a company the union has a dispute with.
It's the iconic symbol of a labor dispute. When they see the rat, without even knowing what's going on, most people understand.
But there's an important distinction. The union's dispute has nothing to do with LG Construction, the business Scabby's in front of today. A banner in front of the rat shows their dispute is with a different business called Brophy Excavation. The Local 150 wants to pressure this construction company to stop doing business with the one they're targeting. And for years, firms like this construction company have been crying foul. They say they're caught in the crossfire between the union and a totally different company. Philip Miscamara is a former member of the National Labor Relations Board, which he calls a miniature Supreme Court for labor law. He says the board had always ruled that it's fair to use Scabby just about anywhere. But then something changed.
The board a couple of months ago solicited briefs and telegraphed the possibility that the board might revisit this area and view these issues differently.
So Miscamara wrote a brief on behalf of retail businesses arguing that installing a giant inflatable rat outside their shop is unfair and scares off customers.
Whether or not you like large inflatable rats, the underlying message is there's a dispute that these people are having with the party that is directly behind the rat.
But Ed Maher with the Local 150 argues that these inflatables should be allowed to roam free under the First Amendment.
Scabby the rat has free speech rights. This is a protected symbol of free speech. Pure as that.
Now, after months of deliberation, the NLRB has sided with the union, and Scabby and his inflatable friends can be used as part of a protest wherever unions want. With a more union-friendly administration, unions hope it's the first in a series of wins for labor. Even so, the inflatable rat's fate could be appealed. And if that happens, Ed Maher says his union will be ready for the fight.
We're fighting for any worker's just most basic rights to go out and say, I've got something to say, come listen to me. And if this big inflatable rat will encourage people to come listen to him, good.
Maher says they'll continue to deploy Scabby and other huge inflatables because they work. They help draw attention to the labor issues the union wants to focus on. For NPR News, I'm Justin Hicks.
Justin, that was such an excellent piece. And I'll say this, the first time I went to Chicago, I saw an inflatable rat. And I was like, what is going
they're
on?
They're all over out there.
Yeah, I was like, is there everywhere. A carnival? Is there a circus? What's happening? so let's talk about your story a little bit here. There's not really mention of Indiana, but there's a strong connection to Indiana. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, of course. So in journalism, sometimes things get cut for time. And this was one of them. The Indiana connection definitely got cut for time. So basically, just like with every legal case, you know, a lot of times if you want to test an idea or a principle, you have to have one particular instance to focus on, right? And actually, the particular instance which brought this case about had to do with Lippert components here in Elkhart. So Lippert components makes parts for RVs. It's not like, you know, the flashy parts that you would recognize. It's, you know, like maybe an awning or something like that, like little pieces. And the exact same union that I featured in this story, the Local 150 out of Chicago, represents some workers who work in construction, which doesn't really have much to do with Lippert. But basically, Lippert got caught in the crosswire between this union and another company that Lippert was using. You know, I think they were renting cranes from them. It was a South Bend company that had cranes. So essentially, Lippert was not necessarily involved in the labor dispute. It was between the union and the crane company. But because Lippert did business with the crane company, the union said, why don't we pressure them to stop doing business, to talk to the crane company and say, hey, you got to do something different. Yeah, it was very interesting. It was all the particular case that was involved had to do with Indiana companies. But this is an issue that happens everywhere. It's called secondary action is the term for it. And the best metaphor that I can think of to help you understand is, you know, imagine you and your best friend get in a fight, right? And then you go to their partner and you say, hey, you should break up with your best friend there. You know, they're being a jerk. You should break up with them. And essentially, secondary action and what employers say is, whoa, wait a second, you know, I have nothing to do with this. Why are you coming to me and telling me I should essentially break off my connection to this other business? So it revolves a lot around that. And I think it's just kind of a fascinating topic.
Yeah, it is. Especially when you think about that, it's like the secondary thing. It's not necessarily that specific company that's being targeted, but someone they're doing business with. With federal labor laws, there are certain things unions can't do to employees who are neutral. So why are they able to inflate these big rats?
Yeah, so it comes down to these two definitions. So unions, when we think of what unions do typically when they are on the streets, right, we typically think of unions striking. And that's called picketing. Like the legal term for that is picketing. And that comes from like, you know, your old 1920s, 1930s idea of like holding signs, you know, maybe some sandwich board kind of things, you know, and they're standing outside and they're saying like, no, we won't go, you know, that kind of stuff. So there's picketing. And there's another thing called bannering. And that's another legal definition. And bannering is essentially when you are not, you know, creating a lot of ruckus per se, but you're just handing out pieces of paper kind of quietly and kind of saying, hey, this is what's going on in that business. So the NLRB for a long time has basically said, since these inflatable rats have come along, they say essentially these rats are quiet. You inflate them, they sit there passively on the sidewalk. And so the NLRB has always said that these rats are basically more like bannering. It's a big inflatable banner. You can think of it that way. And it's not picketing. And the NLRB basically says for secondary employers, you're not allowed to picket because, you know, essentially saying that goes too far. But they've said that because the rats fall under the bannering aspect, then you are able to do that. So basically what companies are saying, though, is that these rats are more than bannering. They want the NLRB to say these rats go further than just passing out information.
Well, in the piece, you mentioned the NLRB changed its mind and opened up the possibility for outlawing scabby in some situations. That's the rat. Do we know why it did that?
Yeah, so back in 2019, I believe it was, maybe 2018, but I think it was 2019, the Trump administration appointed a new general counsel to the NLRB. And the general counsel is essentially the lawyer who decides what cases the NLRB is going to hear and which cases they're not going to hear. Because remember, with all these little regional offices, most of the NLRB and labor dispute cases get solved on a very local level. So usually nothing really rises to the, you know, the level of having to go to this whole review board. So Trump appointed this general counsel to the review board who started kind of reopening cases that were already decided on a local level. And basically signaling, hey, we're going to take a closer look at some different things. And one of the cases that he reopened was this case between the union and Liberate Components that involved putting up a rat outside of an RV trade show. So it was case closed. A Trump-appointed lawyer for the NLRB opened it. Since then, Biden has actually summarily fired that lawyer. It was one of the first things he did when he came into office. And there's actually some contention, by the way, as to whether Biden could legally do that. So that's still kind of working its way in a totally separate court. But that's essentially what it was. It was kind of a Trump administration effort, if you will, to kind of go after Scabby. At least that's how it was interpreted.
So it's kind of like a blip in the timeline of this rat.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is not the first time this rat has gone all the way to the review board, the National Labor Review Board, ever since, you know, the 90s and the early 2000s when this rat started, you know, becoming used more and more often. It's been constantly reviewed by this board, and they constantly keep saying the rat is bannering. The rat can be used on secondary employers. But this Trump administration lawyer wanted to revisit that.
And what is the outcome for labor unions with all of this?
Yeah, so labor unions obviously see this as a win. They would love to, and I don't want to generalize here, but you know, they see this as a form of protest, as a form of free speech, and they see this as, you know, if I'm advocating for the rights of workers here, you know, whatever strategy we're using, as long as it gets the desired effect, which is, you know, keeping workplaces safer or getting people better pay or better benefits or better, you know, union contracts. As long as it's in service of that, we feel like we should be able to do whatever we need to. So obviously unions like this. They like the fact that Scabby can go anywhere he wants, essentially. And they also see it as kind of a sign of support and maybe hopefully one of the first of many wins that they hope will happen in the Biden administration. Of course, the big win that they're really looking for now, and this is important to know, is the PRO Act, which is, you know, might be heard in Congress. And the PRO Act's important, actually, because the PRO Act would actually remove all sort of prohibitions on what you can do against these neutral employers. So the PRO Act would actually change a lot of this.
All right, well, we'll keep an eye on that, and hopefully we can get an update from you again. Justin Hicks, Workforce Development Reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, based up north in Elkhart. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking live with reporters from around the state to find out what they've been working on up next. We'll get the latest figures on the pandemic in Indiana and learn about the latest efforts around redistricting. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking to some of the many public media reporters working on different beats around the state to find out what they're up to and dig deeper into some of the stories they've published in the last week. With us now is Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and we're going to catch up on the latest news and numbers around the COVID-19 pandemic. Lauren, the headline of one of your stories late last week was Delta is causing a surge in new cases in Indiana. How much of a surge are we seeing?
Yeah, it's a pretty significant surge. Just last week, we reported 10,000 new cases over the course of 7 days, which was the first time we had reported that many new cases since early February. And it just kind of keeps getting worse from there. July 3rd was Indiana's pandemic low for hospitalizations, about 371 people who were hospitalized. And as of today, the Indiana Department of Health reported 1,318 Hoosiers hospitalized for COVID-19. So that's a 250% increase in just 38 days for Hoosiers who are hospitalized for severe illness from COVID-19. And of course, it's not just a small group of people that are, you know, causing these spikes. The state averaged about 285 new cases per day in June, which was actually a pandemic low. But July jumped to more than 600 new cases. And so far in August, we've averaged nearly 1,700 new cases per day. Today's count, 2,234 new cases, is the highest since a spike in mid-April of 2,355.
Wow, that's quite a jump, just hearing those numbers. And are health officials saying anything that they're expecting this to spike or get to a peak and then come back down in the coming months?
Yeah. So based on how Delta has kind of moved through other countries, including India, including Great Britain, a lot of folks are anticipating something pretty similar to happen in Indiana. Dr. Robin Ledyard, who is the Community Health Network Chief Medical Officer, said to me when we were talking for the Delta FAQ that you referenced, that she's anticipating, she and other healthcare workers across the state are anticipating this surge to continue through mid-September, hitting its peak in about mid-September, and then seeing a drop off from there. The one thing that she and other healthcare workers are really concerned about, specifically hospitals, I'm not speaking for the State Department of Health and their current predictions, but the other thing that's kind of floating out there is the timing of these variants as they are moving through the U.S. population. We've heard a little bit about the Lambda variant in Texas and other southwestern states picking up a little bit more. That had moved through South America and had caused surges there as well, but not quite to the extent that we saw with the Delta variant. And early research has raised some concerns about the efficacy of vaccines against the Lambda variant, though the Delta variant, it is very important to note, the Delta variant is still, we're still dealing with about the same vaccine efficacy that we did with the original version of COVID. It's just no vaccine is 100% effective, and that's the reason we have breakthrough cases.
Right, right. And when we look at sort of the seasons that, that COVID's been going through, we've seen fall, summer, winter, spring. Now we're going to get through to the winter again. It's coming up. And that tends to be a rougher time for COVID, for the numbers. Are you seeing any concern around that with health officials this year?
Yeah, I mean, the anticipation is that this current surge that we are dealing with right now with the Delta variant, the best guess that hospitals across the state have is that it will be about 50% as bad as the winter was, based on the number of folks that we have fully vaccinated, based on the number of infections in the state. We can anticipate hospitalizations and cases to be about 50% as bad as this last winter, when we saw, you know, more than 8,000 new cases over several days.
And when we're thinking about this variant and what's happening, I think what I'm wondering is, are some of these numbers based on or projections of things peaking and falling based on assumptions that people are going to get vaccinated? I mean, if we go at the pace that we're at now and people don't get vaccinated, it seems like it's going to be pretty deadly.
Yeah, I mean, Dr. Ledger said it during our interview that this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated, but there's also been a lot of reporting, especially from a really incredible PBS NewsHour piece, that the unvaccinated are starting to really be a liability for those who are vaccinated, talking about those breakthrough cases, of course, that do happen. The other thing is that there's at least a little bit of positive news that we are seeing a very small increase in new and first doses. So we've seen about a little bit more than double the number of new vaccinations over the last several weeks as to the previous like 2 months. So we are starting to see that uptick happen. It is by no stretch of the imagination the kind of vaccinations numbers that we saw, you know, back in April, back in March, but we're seeing a very slight, cautiously optimistic increase.
Right. And I think, you know, unless we go into another lockdown, it's still kind of tough to get people to see the importance of vaccines who don't want to get vaccinated. But I wonder if the Delta variant and learning just about how more severe it can be is pushing folks to get vaccinated.
Yeah, a couple of the epidemiologists and Dr. Ledger have said to me that this is something that they're seeing, that people are seeing how bad the Delta variant can be and are getting through to a lot of folks who were hesitant to get the vaccine because of medical concerns, because of convenience, because of, you know, any number of reasons why they would be hesitant to get the vaccine. That Delta is spurring folks a bit more into action than we have seen previous, especially when our cases were so far down. The question that a lot of those folks have brought up, however, is is it enough in order to, you know, flatten the curve of the surge that we're seeing right now?
And before we let you go, are you hearing any other optimistic outlooks from the folks that you talk to?
Optimism might be a bit of a stretch. mostly just it's the same chorus that we've heard time and time again, right? It's wash your hands, wear a mask, get vaccinated, social distance. We know how to limit the spread. We know how to do these things. And while there is limitation in what our local officials can do because of actions by the state legislature, there are things on an individual level that you can do to try and limit the spread.
Well, thank you so much, Lauren. We really appreciate you taking the time to give us the latest update. Lauren Chapman is the digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We're going to move on now to a story on redistricting efforts in Indiana. And to help us through it, we're joined by State House reporter Brandon Smith. Welcome back, Brandon.
Thanks for having me on.
So there were some hearings over the weekend about redistricting. Can you explain what was being discussed and how it all came about?
Sure. So this is an effort by House and Senate Republicans in Indiana to have public hearings about redistricting. And like they did 10 years ago, they wanted to have them out and around the state, not just at the State House like a normal legislative committee hearing. So they had multiple locations last Friday and Saturday around the state in the northern and southern parts of Indiana. And then tomorrow, Wednesday, here at the State House, both the House and Senate committees will come together for a joint meeting in which they're trying to gather feedback from the public about what the next round of maps should be like, you know, how that process should work, what Hoosiers are hoping to see out of the maps, that sort of thing. But it's very important to note that we aren't at none of these meetings, whether over the weekend or the one here at the State House tomorrow, we're not going to see the actual maps that they are proposing to use. We won't see those maybe for a few more weeks.
And just to clarify, these hearings or these discussions, the public can take part in this?
Yeah, this is specifically designed to have Hoosiers come out and talk to lawmakers in a public setting, like a normal hearing at the State House during the session, only they're out and about in various places around the state. It's designed to have the public come out and talk to them about, again, what they want to see out of these maps. But without actual drawn maps to look at, there's a question of how useful these hearings can actually be.
And I also wonder, for people who might not be, I guess, redistricting buffs, if they want to take part, it's just like, what would that be like when they show up to a hearing if they're just learning for the first time?
Yeah, that can be a little tricky. I think you'd want to hear a lot. I don't know. We'll see if it's included tomorrow. But I don't think you're learning a lot in terms of from the General Assembly, from the lawmakers who are actually there. It's a lot more of, well, we want, you know, lawmakers want to hear from the public about what you want. So you kind of have to go in knowing a little bit, I think, about what's already being discussed. And I can't underemphasize the importance of redistricting. If you care about anything in your community, the policies that are passed at a state level, which affect your lives every single day, the amount of funding that your local school gets, whether or not your local roads are getting the necessary amount of money to get built, and any number of 100 or 1,000 different other things in your community, redistricting affects all of that because it will decide in large part who is representing you at the State House for the next decade.
That's a lot to take in. I'm just thinking about that. A decade. That's a long time. And a lot of things can happen.
Yeah, you don't get a second chance at this one for a long time.
So what is at stake when it comes to Indiana with the redistricting? Is there anything specific or is it a bunch of different issues?
Yeah, like I said, it's really any issue that comes before state lawmakers. So there have been a lot of complaints over the last decade about the maps that were drawn in 2011 and how they favored Republicans. Now, Indiana is undoubtedly a Republican state. It would be difficult to draw fair maps that would produce Democratic majorities in the Indiana House or the Indiana Senate. You could draw maps that probably do that, but they would be borderline illegal, if not outright illegal, based on the few federal rules that govern redistricting. But what a lot of folks have said and some studies have borne out is that the representation at the State House over the last 10 years with the current set of maps that we're under right now unfairly favor Republicans, because Republicans currently have supermajorities in the House and Senate. And so what redistricting reform advocates have been working for a decade is, well, one, they wanted an independent commission instead of lawmakers to draw the district lines. That didn't happen. And so now it's pushing them to sort of, you know, there are a lot of different factors you can consider when you're drawing a legislative map. One of them is compactness, which is the idea of the districts should look kind of the same. They should be fairly compact. They shouldn't make a bunch of weird shapes and go all over the place. You should take into account things that are called communities of interest. So if where I live looks substantially similar to a town a couple miles away from me, we should probably be in the same district if at all possible. But if I'm a couple miles away from a farming community that doesn't really have a lot in common with where I live in an urban area, should we be in the same district? But what a lot of advocates have been calling for leading up to this year's redistricting effort, which is competitive districts. They want to see districts that both Democrats and Republicans have at least some chance of winning, because even if Republicans will keep a majority at the state house, and they almost certainly would under any maps you draw, there's a question of if the districts can at least be more competitive, that's a better system for getting representation.
Well, in your story, you mentioned data from the federal government that hasn't come in yet. Can you tell us what that data is and why it's considered important?
Yeah, it's the data from the U.S. Census. So the U.S. Census Bureau last year, in a rather trying circumstances in the middle of the pandemic, conducted the decennial census once every 10 years. And that gets a measure of, or at least the closest possible measure of, how many people live in this country and where they live. And so we got the big number months ago, that this is Indiana's population. And it grew, and we're not going to lose any congressional seats because of the way those are meted out according to population changes. But what we've been waiting for, and we're going to get, it looks like, in a couple of days, finally, is the more low-level data, which is exactly how many people live in this city, in this town, in this neighborhood, everywhere in Indiana. And that will decide how those maps can be redrawn, because there, like I said, there are a few federal rules regarding how maps have to be drawn. And one of them is they have to be pretty close to each other in terms of the number of people who live in each district. So in order to draw the maps, you have to know how many people there are and exactly where they live, so that you can draw the districts to be really close to each other in terms of population. You're allowed slight variances in population, but they're very small, or you could get sued and the maps could get thrown out.
Well, this map, the new mapping, could it flip districts?
Flip districts? Absolutely. We've seen in the past, and this is probably going to happen again because of population shifts, a lot of times you'll see lawmakers who used to be in two different districts drawn into the same district based on where they live. And so then it becomes a matter of lawmakers deciding, am I going to try and run for this new seat against somebody I've been serving with? Am I going to retire? We saw that last time where people were drawn into the same districts and one of those lawmakers just ended up retiring. It could flip districts. It could draw lawmakers into the same districts. And one of the things a lot of people are expecting is it's going to condense a lot of these districts, because what we think we know is that there has been a population shift over the last 10 years of people moving away from rural parts of Indiana and into urban parts of Indiana. And if you have to keep those districts relatively consistent in the number of people who live in them, that means those rural districts are going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and the urban districts are going to get smaller and tighter and smaller.
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, I'm just putting it all into perspective and realizing that might not be such a good thing. Necessarily.
But it's also a reality. There are, you know, you throw out any argument about fairness, you have to do certain things when you draw these maps. And if people live where they live, you're going to have to draw those districts a little tighter. It'll be an interesting exercise to see how Republicans draw them and whether or not they draw them in a way that all but guarantees supermajorities for the foreseeable future.
Well, before we let you go, these new maps are expected in late September. Is that a hard date it's going to happen, or it could?
No, but yes and no. What we've heard is that the Republicans in the legislature are planning on having regular committee hearings at the State House and using the regular legislative process to pass the maps in late September. We expect that they'll stick to that, so that's when we should expect to see it.
All right, well, thank you so much, Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with public media reporters across the state, catching up on their latest work. After this break, we'll hear about a health equity story on blood transfusions, and later we'll find out about an amateur historian working to tell the story of an important figure in Indianapolis. I'm Miriam Soap, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're talking to public media reporters from around the state to dig deeper into some of their recently published stories. And we're joined now by Farah Yousri, health equity reporter for Side Effects Public Media, to talk about a recent piece on blood transfusions. So good to have you with us again, Farah.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this blood shortage. How bad is the shortage in African-American blood and stem cell donors?
Yeah, so there is a big gap between the demand for African-American blood and stem cell donors and the supply. So according to the Red Cross, only 3% of blood donors in the U.S. are African-American, and it's estimated that in Indianapolis, it's even less. And for stem cell donors, the numbers aren't much better, which leaves many African-American patients who need life-saving transplants waiting and sometimes even not making it because they can't find a match.
Oh, well, why does the race of the blood and stem cell donor matter?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when we talk about blood types, we normally talk about types A, B, O, AB, and positive or negative on top of that. But on the red blood cells, there are different combinations of proteins and sugars called antigens. And these antigens differ from one person to another, and actually even from one ethnicity to another. So an African-American patient is more likely to find their closest match in a pool of African-American donors. And that's especially crucial for people who get frequent blood transfusions, like those who live with sickle cell disease and those with certain blood cancers. And the reason these patients need the closest match possible is because every time the body receives blood, it detects any small differences between its own blood and the donor's blood, and then it starts to form antibodies to attack the foreign cells. So if patients are given blood that doesn't match as exactly as possible, their bodies will form these antibodies, and with every single transfusion, that will happen. And so I spoke to some sickle cell disease patients who need blood transfusions every 3 to 4 months for the past 20 years. So for them to be able to continue getting these life-saving transfusions, they need to find their closest match.
Wow, that's really interesting. I didn't even know this was an issue, so thank you for bringing that to light. Is it clear what impact this shortage is having on people in Indiana?
So in Indiana, and I would imagine in many other states, there are patients who need a transfusion or a transplant, and they're just left waiting for days or maybe longer. And I do know that at the Indiana Hemophilia and Thrombosis Center, for example, a physician assistant told me that they do have a few patients right now who do not have a blood match in the state of Indiana. And so when they show up in severe pain and with the risk of organ failure, they may be told they need to wait for a few days until they find their blood match. And so as if living with sickle cell disease or blood cancer isn't stressful enough, now you're also adding the stress of actually finding the blood and if and when this will happen. And mind you also that African Americans are already at a much greater risk of having sickle cell disease and many types of cancers that might need blood transfusions or bone marrow transplants. And so with this shortage, it's really a compounded effect.
I mean, that's horrible that folks will have to wait around and see if there's a blood match when there isn't enough around. Is there anything else that can be done? Do they get sent to another state? Or, I mean that's probably tough as well, but...
Yeah, so usually blood centers have some kind of open system, open relationship between each other. So they could share with each other, and if there's a blood match in a certain state, they could have it delivered to other states when needed. So the process is usually that the healthcare provider would reach out to other states and ask if they have a match for this patient. But this process can take something like 3 days. And sometimes 3 days is too long when the patient is in excruciating pain, they can't go to work or take care of their family, or even is at risk of stroke or organ failure or even death, you know? So, yeah, there is a process, but it's, sometimes it's not good enough for patients who are just waiting.
So what is the reason behind the shortage? Is there any information on why there aren't enough donors?
So like many health disparities, this is a complex and multifactorial issue. Of course, lack of awareness is a big one. People don't know there is a shortage and or that they need to donate or where and how they can donate. But also there is mistrust in the historically white medical establishment, which has subjected the Black community to many unethical experiments. Also, blood donation itself has a racist history. So in the early 1900s, the Red Cross used to segregate African-American blood and white blood, not based on any science at the time, but out of racism. And there are even accounts of African-Americans showing up to donate blood after major events like Pearl Harbor and World War II, and they would be turned away because their blood wasn't deemed suitable. And so it's a legacy of systemic racism, and these stories are passed on from generation to another.
Well, what did you learn about any solutions for making things better?
Yeah, so actually the way I was introduced to this story was when I was at the Black Expo. So there was a booth that a blood center called Versity Blood Center had at the Indiana Black Expo Health Fair. And they had the booth staffed with an all African-American nurse and technician crew. They would engage with the fair visitors and educate them about the need and the shortage and ask if they would want to donate at the booth. These efforts are much, much needed. It was a nice effort. There was some modest engagement, not as much as they'd hoped, but like these small efforts would have a cumulative effect at the end. So there is an increasing awareness of the problem. And, you know, there are also many conversations being had at the moment about health disparities in general and the legacy of medical racism and how we can best address that. And I believe this would also help us address some of the mistrust that the Black community has when it comes to blood donation and stem cell donation and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. Awareness is the first step to learning more about what we can do to fix the situation. Well, Farah, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you on. Farah Yousry is a health equity reporter for Side Effects Public Media. We're going to head over now and speak with Dylan Pierce-McCoy, investigative education reporter at WFYI, and Randy Wilson, the subject of Dylan's recent feature story on a historical Indianapolis figure. Welcome to both of you. Dylan, who was Bessie Spates, and why was she an important figure in Indianapolis's history?
Yeah, thanks for having us. So I guess I just want to start with saying pretty much everything we know about Bessie Spates right now is because of Randy's research into her. Bessie appears to be the first Black woman to graduate from Arsenal Technical High School, which is Indianapolis High School on the east side of downtown. It's a historic school that was historically white. But she graduated from the school in 1916, just a few years after it opened. Then she went on to become a teacher in Indianapolis public schools for over 30 years. Her parents were born during the Civil War, and her father was a sharecropper. Yet Bessie not only graduated from high school, but also became a teacher. She earned a college degree from Butler University. And I think remembering her story is valuable because it's one of many stories that gives a face to the discrimination that Black people dealt with, but also the perseverance they showed and sort of what she overcame to really serve generations of Indianapolis students.
Can you give us some context on the district where Bessie graduated and how that history intersects with her story?
Yeah. So one of the reasons why I think her story is interesting and is something is that she graduated in 1916, right? So a lot of times when we think about integration, we think of it as something that happened during the civil rights era. But in fact, Indianapolis high schools were integrated at the turn of the 20th century for many years because Indiana law said that Black students were entitled to an education and they didn't have a high school for Black students. There wasn't a segregated school for them. So they were allowed to go to white schools. But at the same time, like, years after Bessie graduated, Tech actually did become an all-white school. It was segregated because Indianapolis opened Crispus Attucks High School, which was a segregated Black school. And during her whole teaching career, she was teaching at a segregated elementary school. So I think it's kind of interesting that we learn her story through her story that segregation in Indianapolis schools wasn't a linear process. It wasn't that schools used to be segregated and then they became integrated. There was actually sort of this push and pull where schools that had been integrated became segregated. And it took years before the courts integrated them again.
Randy, how did you find out about Bessie?
Through one of my yearbooks. She was in the class of 1916 January class yearbook. And she was the only African-American in there and the first female to graduate from Tech.
And what made you decide to look into this?
Well, we had a website, a forerunner to Facebook, and I used to put historic things on about our school. So one year, about 12 years ago during Black History Month, I thought I would feature the first female to graduate from Tech and give a little overview about her. And that's kind of what got me started looking into that.
And you also led a campaign to get a headstone on Bessie Spaeth's grave. Can you talk about what motivates you to do that?
Well, for one thing, I noticed for the 10 years or more that I would visit her grave that she'd had no headstone, so a grave marker. So we were coming up on our 1970, class of 1970 was having a 50-year reunion, and it's commonplace for Tech High School 50-year reunion classes to have a special project where you kind of give back to the school. So I took it to some of my classmates about, you know, it'd be something different and unique if we was able to procure a headstone for her. And we took it from there and just took a donation up. And other alumni donated also, but I was just going to buy one myself and put on there. And I thought, you know, it would be better if more people could take a part in this and be a part of it.
Well, Dylan, what role do stories like this play at Indianapolis Public Schools at this moment?
Yeah, so Indianapolis Public Schools is now majority students of color. And the administration, I think, is increasingly comfortable talking about race, especially the superintendent they have now. Last year, the school board approved a racial equity resolution, and they were really frank about sort of the school district's history of supporting systemic racism. And so there's been this ongoing conversation about race in IPS. And when I talk to Pat Payne, who runs the Racial Equity Office and is sort of seen as the person who more than anyone else has led the push for this, for improving our understanding and discussion of racism and history in IPS, she said that Bessie's story is really important. She'd never heard of it before Randy did this research. And she felt like it was a real gift to learn about her because teaching students about Bessie is another way of teaching them about Black history that goes beyond just slavery and persecution. It shows that sort of despite the barriers she faced, Bessie was an accomplished woman who helped educate generations of Indianapolis children and sort of fills out our picture of Black history in Indianapolis public schools.
And what do you think about the fact that there's so much interest in this specific story? What does it say?
I just think we're eager to learn more about the people that are behind the history of the district. You know, Bessie was remarkable because she was the first Black woman to graduate from Tech. At the time she was going to the school, she probably faced a lot of racism. And she did teach for more than 30 years. But also, in some ways, she seems like just one person of sort of like a tapestry of the people that whose stories are remarkable but get lost in history. And I think there's a real eagerness to hear about that now as we sort of reflect on Indianapolis public schools history.
And Randy, you mentioned that you had been visiting Bessie's grave and you noticed there wasn't a headstone and stuff. So, I mean, it sounds like you really were invested in her and her story. What was it that pulled you into that?
Well, I guess just the respect for what she did. For what she did back in the time frame based on her economic setting and standing. I mean, there were many African Americans back then that were much, much more affluent than she was. But yet she, under the circumstances of coming from a poor family in Kentucky to graduate, it was a very remarkable accomplishment she did. And I just thought it'd be, you know, it's just in our culture, it's commonplace for people to have grave markers and headstones, and here she didn't have one.
She did a lot in her life. How do you think she should be remembered?
Well, I think she could be remembered as a person that had, you know, determination. Determination goes a long ways in life. And she could just as well not, you know, worked hard to do what she did under the circumstances. So, I mean, I think we should always keep in mind that determination is a big thing in our lives, regardless of who you are, or where you are.
Well, Dylan, when you found out about the story and started working on it, what was there anything that surprised you?
Huh. You know, I'm not sure. I guess one thing that's interesting to me is how, like, what we notice now, we sort of was not remembered or celebrated. Like, you know, Randy found her as the first Black woman who graduated from Tech, but I went back and looked at an article that the Indianapolis Recorder wrote about her when she retired as a teacher. And it was a nice article, and they talked about her impact as a teacher. She taught special ed and sort of what people admired about her. But nowhere in that article did they mention that she was the first Black woman to graduate from Tech. So I think it's really interesting that the way in which we endow things with significance now, with the benefit of retrospect. And at the time, they just sort of were taken for granted.
I can see that where, you know, it's you don't realize someone did something so historic and remarkable until you dig around later. Well, Randy, is there anything you think our audience should know about Bessie before we say goodbye?
Well, if you want to go out and visit her grave, she's at the Floral Park Cemetery, and she has a very nice grave marker there. And I would particularly like to thank all the folks who helped donate to make this happen. And it was really a special thing that our class was able to do it, and we're very proud of what we did. It's something that had never been done as far as a graduating class that I know of. And we also have a scholarship fund that's going to be a foregoing thing in the future. And in her memory and in her honor, we're going to try to keep a scholarship going to support kids going into college from Tech High School.
Thank you so much to both of you for taking the time to join us this afternoon. Dylan Pierce McCoy is an investigative education reporter at WFYI, and Randy Wilson is the subject of Dylan's recent feature story about Bessie Spates, which you can find on WFYI.org. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.